The anniversary of the October 7th terror attacks.
Israel has had a series of conflicts with Hamas in Gaza that have lasted from a few days to a few weeks, but never an entire year.
Israeli attacks hit a mosque and school.
The Israeli military called the attack precise strikes on Hamas terrorists who were operating embedded in the school and mosque.
As immigration is an important campaign issue, immigrants who are eligible to vote must make a choice.
I am scared. The fear of immigrants is starting up again. The fear of black and brown people is starting up again.
Today is Monday, October 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Today is the one-year anniversary of the October 7th terror attacks by Hamas on southern Israel. It was that attack that sparked the hostilities we're currently seeing in the Middle East. Since then, world leaders and teams of negotiators have been unable to bring an end to the fighting as the hostilities spread. As recently as late last week, U.S. President Joe Biden urged Israel to consider other alternatives to striking Iranian oil facilities and said Israel had not yet concluded how to respond to Tehran's recent missile attacks. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has the story.
A series of Israeli airstrikes target Iran-backed Hezbollah in the southern suburbs of the Lebanese capital, Beirut, Friday, as Israeli troops push inside southern Lebanon. Israel is also weighing its retaliation options for Tehran's 180 missile attack earlier this week, including whether to attack Iranian oil facilities.
The Israelis have not concluded what they're going to do in terms of a strike. That's under discussion. I think if I were in their shoes, I'd be thinking about other alternatives.
That was President Joe Biden in a surprise appearance at the White House briefing room Friday, the first in his almost 4 years in office. Biden said earlier this week that he didn't support Israel targeting Iranian nuclear sites. The Iranian oil industry is mostly sanctioned, and an attack on its facilities would have little impact on global supply. But Tehran's retaliation still could be disruptive. Ellen Lipson is the director of the International Security Program Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University.
If Iran then were to retaliate by blocking the Strait of Hormuz, it would affect not only Iranian oil exports, but the oil exports of many of the Gulf countries, the Gulf Arab countries. So that could be catastrophic for world energy supplies.
Since Hamas' October 7th attack that triggered Israel's war against the militant group in Gaza, Biden has struggled to contain the conflict. It has now spread not only to Lebanon, but also the West Bank, where an Israeli airstrike at the refugee camp Friday killed 18 Palestinians, the deadliest attack in the Israeli-occupied territory since the start of the Gaza war. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has not heeded Biden's calls for a ceasefire in Gaza or Lebanon. Ending the war is a key issue for Americans ahead of the November presidential election.
No administration has helped Israel more than I have. None. 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 And I think Bibi should remember that. And whether he's trying to influence the election, I don't know, but I'm not counting on that.
In a show of support to Hezbollah, Iran's top diplomat delivered this warning in Beirut just hours after Israel's airstrikes. Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi.
If the Israeli entity takes any step or measure against us, our retaliation will be stronger than the previous one.
Meanwhile, to deter further escalation, the U.S. military Friday struck military sites in Yemen to target the Houthis, another Iranian-backed proxy that has attacked shipping lanes in the Red Sea. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News at the White House.
And the fighting continues. Israeli authorities say its fighter jets conducted intelligence-based strikes on terror targets in Beirut belonging to Hezbollah's intelligence headquarters, including command centers and additional terrorist infrastructure sites. It's the most intense bombardment of the Lebanese capital since the conflict escalated last month. And as Israel launched more deadly strikes in Gaza on Sunday, Israel's military said it was conducting targeted strikes on Hamas and Hezbollah targets. Reuters' Sean Hogan reports.
Dozens were killed and wounded when Israeli airstrikes hit a mosque and a school sheltering displaced people in the enclave early on Sunday. That's according to the Hamas-run Gaza government media office. The Israeli military called the attack precise strikes on Hamas terrorists who were operating embedded in the school and mosque in the Deir al-Balah area in central Gaza, a claim Hamas rejects. Palestinian health officials said at least another 20 people had been killed since Saturday night in northern Gaza after the Israeli army sent tanks into the area for the first time in months and urged residents to leave. Israel also battered Beirut's southern suburbs overnight through Sunday morning. It's the most intense bombardment of the Lebanese capital since Israel sharply escalated its campaign against Iran-backed group Hezbollah last month. Israel said its air force had conducted a series of targeted strikes on weapons storage facilities and Hezbollah terrorist infrastructure sites. Lebanese authorities did not immediately say what the missiles had hit or what damage they caused. In almost a year of fighting between Hezbollah and Israel, more than 2,000 people have been killed in Lebanon, most of them in the past 2 weeks, according to its health ministry.
That's Sean Hogan of Reuters reporting for us today. By now, we've got a good understanding of what happened on October 7th of last year, and we know about the brutal war that has been going on since. For some context on all this, I'm joined by VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. We know what happened a year ago, and we know what happened since then, but what I'd like to talk to you about is what it's been like this past year in Israel and how the hostilities this time around are different from the previous hostilities.
Sure. Well, you know, first of all, the fact that it's still going on is really hard to fathom. I think, you know, Israel has had a series of conflicts with Hamas in Gaza that have lasted from a few days to a few weeks, but never an entire year. And never before were there hostages. You know, even today, a year later, there are 101 hostages being held in Gaza. Probably about half of them are still alive, maybe even less than that. So it's really kind of created a pall over, you know, the situation. And now the fact that Israel has now started this ground incursion into Lebanon and heavy bombing raids in Lebanon and says that that's the only way that people from the north who were evacuated can go back. And the tensions with Iran, in which everybody is expecting an imminent Israeli response to the Iranian missile strike last week. All of that together, the mood is just kind of very heavy and kind of sad.
And how has everyday life changed?
So I think it depends where you are and how intensely, you know, you personally are involved with that. On one hand, everyday life goes on as normal, right? The restaurants are open. The cafes are open. Israelis are famous for, you know, 10 minutes after a terrorist attack, the cafe reopens and people go back to drinking their coffee. And it's sort of, you know, Israelis are proud of how resilient they are. I think, again, it really depends where you are. You know, I have friends now whose kids have been called up for reserve duty for the third time or the fourth time. If you live in the north, you have been evacuated, you know, close to the border with Lebanon. You haven't been living in your home for the past year. If you live in one of the kibbutzim that was really hard hit on October 7th, many of them have not been able to go back to their homes. So I think it really depends on where you live.
In some international circles, at the UN, in the EU, for example, Israel has really become a pariah for what is seen as a heavy-handed approach, especially in the Gaza Strip. Is there a sense in Israel that perhaps there was an overreaction?
Not really. I'll tell you, first of all, I think that Israelis feel that the October 7th attack was completely unprovoked. And the cruelty of, you know, the rapes and the killings of women and children and babies, and then the hostages. 250 were taken hostage. But what Israelis also say is that, you know, that at least, and you see it every night on Israeli news, the weapons that are being found in people's houses, the entrances from residential houses to the tunnels, you know, that Hamas has used. So I think there's a sense. Now, you know, the truth is I know quite a few people in Gaza, and I don't think they're Hamas supporters. If Hamas comes to you and says, you know, we're using your house for weapons, there's really not much you can do. But the feeling in Israel is not that there was an overreaction. They believe that the Israeli army is trying to avoid civilian deaths, that they told people to leave. There are these humanitarian zones. And when if you say to them, well, Israel's attacking these humanitarian zones as well, you say, well, if the population didn't support Hamas or the population had overthrown Hamas, then no civilians would have been killed. So I really don't sense any kind of feeling among most people, not all, and there are some. But it's also, I think, that there's this sense that Israelis have so much pain themselves from October 7th that they're not really able to feel the pain of Palestinian civilians in Gaza.
Linda, it's the morning of October 7th as we're talking now. What kind of events are expected later in the day?
Well, there's all different kind of events. So, for example, one is that at 6:29, which is when the Hamas attack first started, there's going to be a moment of silence. Some people are going to go out in the streets and blow the shofar, the ram's horn, that's usually blown on Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. There are several, all kinds of commemorative events going on. Some are private. The hostage families have a whole series of events, and they have been campaigning tirelessly to get the remaining hostages released from Gaza. The Israeli government has an event later in the day that was pre-filmed, including interviews and things like that. So there are all kinds of both official and unofficial events, as well as demonstrations planned.
VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for taking the time to be with me on what is no doubt a busy day of reporting.
Okay, thank you.
We're following these other stories from around the world. A massive blast outside Karachi Airport on Sunday injured at least 4 people and destroyed several vehicles. The police and the provincial government said a tanker exploded outside the airport, but the provincial home minister told a local TV station it was an attack on foreign nationals. Spain's King Felipe VI met with Jordan's King Abdullah II in Amman on Sunday. The two leaders discussed the war in the Gaza Strip and Lebanon and the need for the international community to help stop it. Shortly after Hurricane Helene brought death and destruction to much of the American Southeast, Florida is in the path of another hurricane. Hurricane Milton is expected to make landfall on Florida's west coast midweek. Turning to American politics and the presidential election, in the United States, nearly 24 million immigrants are eligible to vote in the November presidential election. This according to a Pew Research Center analysis of U.S. Census data. It shows that even as border security and illegal immigration is an important topic in the upcoming American election, immigrants are also an important constituency of voters to be courted. VOA's Jeff Swikard spoke with 2 naturalized citizens about the choices they're making in this election.
Levon Sayoum is an industrious man working long hours running a small trucking company in Jessup, Maryland. He came to the United States with his family in 2000 to escape war between Ethiopia and Eritrea. Sayoum says he is a fiscal and social conservative and a big supporter of Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump.
When President Trump was in power, it was an amazing type of business. You know, the market was great, the job opportunities were great, and people were optimistic.
Sayoum is a registered Republican who ran for his party's nomination to be Maryland's U.S. Senator. He says businesses like his are feeling the pinch of high fuel prices, which he blames on Democrats.
Right now, unfortunately, with the gas prices, is hovering around $5 for the diesel, $4.50, for the diesel. And that renders this business a lot unprofitable.
Understanding that volatile global oil prices are set by a complex combination of factors, Sayyum says Trump has the answer.
Trump showed us the way to do it. You drill, you drill, you drill, you drill, and then you compete. You see, now we don't need to explore other ideologies.
But Mata Berry sees the choices in this election differently. She came to the United States from Sierra Leone when she was 11. Berry got her law degree, works as a community and civil rights organizer, and is executive director of the Police Accountability Board in Montgomery County, Maryland. She is voting for Kamala Harris.
I think Vice President Kamala Harris is a person for the people. She is the person we need right now to bridge the divide that is in this country.
Berry says she was worried about another Trump presidency.
I am scared. The fear of immigrants is starting up again. The fear of black and brown people is starting up again. And it's hard when the person on top is leading it, so everyone else feels comfortable.
Berry volunteers at a local food bank and says gains in the U.S. economy are not benefiting everyone equally.
The contrast basically is that the top 0.1% will have all the money and the rest of us will be struggling if you go with Trump. And the nation was never built like that. America became America because of the work that the blue-collar workers did in this country.
Pew Research says naturalized citizens account for about 10% of the U.S. electorate. And most of those voters have been here for more than 20 years. Jeff Swicord, VOA News, Silver Spring, Maryland.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karen. From politics in the United States, we turn to politics in Africa as polls close in Tunisia. That's Farouk Bouasker, president of the Independent High Authority for Tunisian Elections, saying that turnout for Tunisia's presidential election stood at a low 27.7%. Exit polls show incumbent president Kais Saied winning against his two rivals, Zuhair Magzouai and Achi Zamel, who had been seen as posing a threat to Saied until he was jailed last month. And about 11,000 kilometers to the south and east, that's Osufu Mamadi, candidate for president of Mozambique. He and his party are running on a platform of economic reform, of cleaning up corruption, and improving infrastructure and education. He's up against Daniel Chapo, the ruling party's candidate. The ruling party is called Frelimo, and they've been in power since Mozambique's independence from Portugal in 1975. They were popular Marxist rebels back then, but now they're seen as corrupt and having been accused of tampering with elections. Election day in Mozambique is October 9th. From southern Africa to southern Europe, in Ukraine, Victor lives in a village with no running water or electricity or neighbors. His town was destroyed during the Russian invasion in 2022. All the residents fled the village, yet Victor, who is 63 years old, chose to return and rebuild his life. Anna Kostachenko met with him.
This is the home of 63-year-old Sulihivka resident Victor Kalibarda. He built this makeshift barn himself from the remains of his former home, destroyed by Russian forces. The village of Sulihivka is about 170 kilometers from the city of Kharkiv. It was shelled ruthlessly during Russia's offensive in the Kharkiv region in the spring of 2022. About 200 people lived here then, but every single house in the village was either severely damaged or destroyed, along with the power lines. Kalibarda says his house was one of the last to go.
When I left, my house was still standing. It got destroyed later. Russians were there for 6 months.
Kalibarda found temporary shelter with strangers in the city of Slovyansk in the Donetsk region. A year later, he was the first one to return to Sulihivka.
This is my home.
Kalibarda owns about 12 hectares of land. He used to raise chickens, geese, rabbits and pigs, as well as grown vegetables. For over a year after his return, he lived without electricity, using solar-powered lamps provided by volunteers. Power lines were restored late this summer, and today volunteers bring him grains and bread once a month. Ukrainian soldiers help as well.
As our military guys are passing by, they leave me cigarettes and share some food with me.
Over time, three more residents have returned to the village inspired by Kalibarda's example. One of them is 56-year-old Serhii Prokopenko, a former Navy serviceman who ran a business in Sulihivka. He used to own more than 100 hectares of land and several tractors and harvesters. Today he cultivates a small plot of land where he grows vegetables. He says the rest is filled with mines.
All our fields are mined because the front line was really close to here. So far, no one is demining the fields. They just cleared a few mines to fix the power lines. But no one is doing anything in the fields. And for the second year now, none of us is harvesting anything.
But neither Prokopenko nor Kalibarda moved back here because they believed restarting and rebuilding would be easy. They say instead they are invested in rebuilding their little town and returning to its former simple glory. Anna Kostyuchenko for VOA News, Kharkiv Region, Ukraine.
Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump falsely claimed in a debate with Democratic candidate Vice President Kamala Harris last month that Haitian immigrants were eating people's pets in the town of Springfield, Ohio. Since then, Haitian media outlets in the U.S. have dealt with threats, online attacks, and harassment. From our press freedom desk, Christina Casiedo-Smith has the story.
Miguelito Jerome, a radio anchor and reporter for New Diaspora Live in Springfield, Ohio, gets ready for his daily radio show. But since Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump claimed in a debate last month that Haitian migrants had been eating people's pets in Springfield, doing his job has been challenging.
To say that it is to classify the Haitian people and the community here in Springfield as something that we're not, and that hurts us. It hurts us as a community.
Jerome has noticed that Trump's comments have made Haitian people in the city afraid to go out in public.
We are afraid of people who will use this comment to tell us things, to harm us, to attack us. People have been intimidated and harassed.
Since the presidential debate, the city of Springfield has received multiple bomb threats, prompting officials to close buildings, increase security in schools, and cancel events. And the threats toward the Haitian community and media expand beyond Ohio. Vania Andre is the editor-in-chief of the Haitian Times, a New York-based English-language paper that serves and reports about the Haitian diaspora. Before the debate, Haitian Times reporters were planning on hosting a town hall in Springfield about white supremacist claims that Haitian migrants were going to wreck the city and steal its resources. Andres says that because of former President Trump's comments, Springfield police advised the staff not to do the event.
In the sense, by that time, we had already started getting just swarms of emails and messages with all types of racial slurs.
The Haitian Times town hall was conducted online. These events, however, have not halted the Haitian Times journalists.
We as a newsroom are even that more motivated to make sure that we are identifying any type of misinformation, disinformation that is tied not just to the Haitian electorate and Haitian immigrants, but just this election in general.
I do want to go to Springfield.
Republican vice presidential candidate and Ohio Senator J.D. Vance has reiterated Trump's comments, saying he is just repeating what his constituents are telling him. Meanwhile, the Haitian Times is strengthening security measures and online protection for its reporters, editors, and staff that it plans to keep in place after the U.S. presidential election. Cristina Caicedo-Smith, VOA News.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online. at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karras.